You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. The Trump presidency will be remembered for firing up activism among women and inspiring more American women than ever before to become politically active and run for office. The third annual Worldwide Women's March happened over the weekend. It was born the day after the inauguration of President Trump in January of 2017. You might know in the news, the Equal Rights Amendment came back into the spotlight after Virginia last week became the 38th state to ratify it. And the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote, has its 100th anniversary coming up this August. However, all that said, if you think that all of this modern political activism among women is remarkable, just go back in history to the time of the First World War and just afterward, when women's worldwide push for a political voice was perhaps reaching its first tipping point. It's an era of events that Dr. Mona Siegel has researched and written about in a new book titled Peace on Our Terms. She is a Sac State professor with a PhD in history, and she's in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Beth.
That was a big, long introduction, but it's not easy to summarize all that's happened in the 100 plus a few years.
It's exactly true. Women's rights, which seem to be such a contemporary issue, have been with us for so very long, and we're revisiting a lot of that past today.
How do you parallel what's happening now with what was happening 100 years ago?
100 years ago, women were insisting really for the first time on a global stage that they had something to contribute, not only in the home, not only in society, but at the very highest levels of diplomacy and governance. And I think that we're seeing the demand for that resurging today.
I called it a tipping point. Women in America were far from alone in pushing for recognition for their rights. Why were so many reclaiming gender equality at that moment in history? And let's be specific about years. Maybe it would start 1914, 17, but definitely into 1918 to 20.
Yes, exactly. I think that couple-year period stretching from 1918 to 1920 globally was an incredibly important moment for women all over the world. It's true that momentum had been building for a long time. Literacy rates had been growing. Women had been getting access to education, both formal and informal. Women's rights had been movements had been building. But World War I was the game changer. Mm-hmm. And that had to do in part with women's experience during the war, with the sense of full citizenship they gained from participating in factories as nurses, in directly aiding the war effort. But it also had to do with what the global statesmen were promising. They said this was a war that was going to make the world safe for democracy, and women believed democracy could not be built without them.
Some of those early arguments, in fact, weren't just about protecting women and tapping into the concern that men, male leaders would have about women and children, but arguing that women had been, in some cases, in battle, but very much involved in the defense of a country, the support of a nation. That was a pretty powerful and provocative argument.
It was a powerful argument, and women throughout the four plus years of World War I were consistently hearing from their governments in the warring nations that what they did was absolutely central to their nation. They hadn't gotten that message before. They had been told what they did was important to their homes and their families, but not to their societies and to their countries. That was a very empowering message to hear, and they didn't forget it when the war was over.
So let's go to the Paris Peace Conference, because the story at this point in time, and certainly the story in your book, springs from this conference and the atmosphere around it. Nothing could have been farther, though, from the minds of the statesmen than to allow a platform and real change for women. So you have this brewing. It's all going to bubble up at the conference, but neither side really knows at that point where the other stands.
Exactly. Although women did not waste any time letting global statesmen like President Woodrow Wilson know that they expected to be on the agenda. My book opens with a French feminist and suffragist who wrote to Woodrow Wilson on that very first day of the peace conference and said that we expect the peace conference to address women's rights. And by the way, when can we have an appointment? Because we plan to come see you. And that's exactly what they did.
It's pretty fascinating that he entertained them a couple times, sometimes meeting in the evening as late as 8:30 at one point, so that he could listen. And you really unwrap the evolvement of his ideas on this. He actually was listening, even if in the end, he didn't turn the listening into action.
Yes. Woodrow Wilson had turned on the issue of women's suffrage here at home over the course of the war. He had gradually been won over. He had people pushing and pulling in all directions. But global feminists saw him as their potential hero as well. They thought that he was the one who was going to champion their cause among the global, among the peacemakers in the room at the Paris Peace Conference. They wanted women's rights and women's suffrage to be built right into those peace treaties at the end of the war.
I'll read a sentence or two here from your book. You write, "Paris and the Peace Conference served as an incubator for these women's sharpening feminist consciousness, even for those women like demonstrators in Egypt and in China who could only protest from afar. There was a feminism mixed with nationalism. One was heard differently than the other from the male leaders. Where do you think the driving sensitivity for these early activists really was for the women? In which arena?
In terms of nationalism or feminism,
yeah.
You mean? I think in some parts of the world, the two were so inextricably wound up that it's absolutely impossible to separate them. In places like Egypt and China, where I'm sure many women all over the world today have no idea that women were rising up and demanding their rights 100 years ago, the battle for a national self-determination, which is what the global peacemakers had promised to deliver to the world in Paris, they assumed would come with individual self-determination. It made no sense to say, we are going to give you, your nation, the freedom to determine its future if the people living in that nation didn't also have the right and the ability to determine that future. And so it is true that women in Cairo, women in Beijing, and in other parts of the world hit the streets and made their voices heard in the first instance, insisting that the Western powers clear out and that imperialism and its after effects come to an end, but also insisting that the states that are built up, were built up in the aftermath included full sovereignty for women as well.
Hmm. So your book features some characters that are recognizable in history. Jane Addams, the American Settlement House pioneer, who was in fact the first American woman to be selected to receive the Nobel Peace Prize. She has a prominent voice, a prominent role. So say a bit about her, but she certainly was not alone. It was collective strategizing and planning that seemed to be continually happening.
Exactly. Jane Addams had been extremely popular as a social activist in the United States in the early 20th century. She helped found a settlement house in Chicago that was known worldwide. But she had embraced the peace movement during World War I and had, in many respects, fallen into disrepute, except among a very small radical core in the United States. When the war was over, she collaborated with European women from both sides of the enemy lines, from Germany as well as France and Britain and neutral nations as well, and gathered in Zurich in order to assert what women's idea of a just peace would be. And in part because of the timing, they met in May of 1919, they became the first organized body anywhere in the world to protest the Versailles Treaty, which had just been made public, the terms of the treaty, and to insist that a just peace would look far different than anything that the men had cooked up in Paris.
A tangent to this is that not all of the women were exactly on the same page. There were suffragettes, mm-hmm. and there were suffragists. And make the distinction.
So the term suffragette was initially used by journalists who were critiquing women's rights activists, women demanding the vote in the United States and also in England, as a way of belittling them. But the women adopted it as their own nomenclature. But the suffragettes were those who embraced confrontational methods, open protests, and even the use of violence in some cases. And that was true in England. It was true in the United States. It was also true in China, where in 1912, there were Chinese suffragettes who broke into the new parliament building and smashed windows in order to demand women's right to vote in China. Suffragists tended to work within the system a little bit more. They were no less determined, no less insistent, but tended to try and use moral pressure to achieve their rights.
I'm talking with Sac State History Professor Dr. Mona Siegel. She is author of the new book, Peace on Our Terms. She has a book signing Friday, January 24th at 7:30 at the Avid Reader Davis, which is at 617 2nd Street. You've mentioned China a couple times. If people know the legend of Mulan, we really need to talk about a character that was a peace delegate who went by a couple different names. She became popular all around the world, including in America. But she is really the real-life combination of the Mulan legend mixed with being a political activist and a fashionista, kind of everything in one. Will you introduce us to Su Mei Cheng?
Absolutely. She, at the risk of upsetting the other historical women in my book, she may be my favorite character. Mm. Su Mei Cheng is her name. Cheng Yushi was her given name in China. She was born in the late Qing Dynasty in the 1890s in an extremely wealthy family in southern China, destined for a life of subservience and domesticity. And from the age of 6 onward, she rebelled against it. When her grandmother came to bind her feet, she tore the bandages off and threw a temper tantrum till her grandmother gave up. When her family selected a suitor for her to become her husband, who did not believe in women's education, who did not believe in modern devices like telephones, against her family's wishes, she wrote him a letter and said, "I'm not interested," and broke off the engagement. She went on from there to become a revolutionary, supporting Dr. Sun Yat-sen's movement to overthrow the Qing dynasty, mm-hmm. at one point smuggling bombs into Beijing in order to support the movement. All this activities, you might imagine, was extraordinarily risky. And eventually her family, in part in order to protect her, sent her off to Europe. And there she went to Paris in 1913, began studying law at the Sorbonne, and so was in Europe when World War I broke out, saw it close up, was a firm supporter of China joining the Allies in World War I. And because of all this background activity in 1919, when the war was over, because China had supported the winning side, they got a seat at the peace table. And unbeknownst to them, they became the only country anywhere in the world to appoint a woman to their official peace delegation. That woman was Su Mei Cheng.
Her work and her arrival at the Paris Peace Conference was unbeknownst to, for example, the American or the British delegation. But that's why I say it seems like such a tipping point, because it was all converging at the same time. These stories about Su Mei are amazing, including using the branch of a rose bush to look like a gun at one point, which involved the signing or not signing of the Treaty of Versailles. Oh my gosh, it's so rich. There is a memoir that she's written about her years, but if you look for the memoir of Su Mei Cheng, you won't find it that way, will you?
No, she her memoir is sadly out of print, although I'd love to see it come back again. But she later in life married a man by the name of Wei Taoming. Wei Taoming actually became the ambassador to the United States from China during World War II. And so after her marriage, she went under her married name, and Madame Wei Taoming was how she was known and published.
So her memoir is titled My Revolutionary Years, the autobiography of Madame Wei Taoming. You were going to go to a conference this past year, in June of this past year, and present some of what you discovered in your research. How did that go? Did that happen? How did they respond to your work?
Yes, I went to Paris in June of 2019, so exactly 100 years after the Paris Peace Conference was signed. I met with a whole absolutely fabulous group of international scholars assessing the legacy of 1919, 100 years later. And it was actually Su Mei Cheng's story that I chose to share with them. This was a group of diplomatic historians who had no idea this woman existed.
Wow.
And so to them, she just came out of the woodwork. And it was a fabulous conference, which I have to say ended in the Hall of Mirrors at the Palace of Versailles, where that treaty was signed 100 years ago.
So we diverted there to China, but Egypt is another country. This movement involved working women, a labor movement, as well as African-American women, women from around the world. But the key question in the midst of all of this seemed to be, would men listen? So address that question and how that evolved.
I think that's absolutely right. Women, because of the rich diversity of nationalities and religions and social classes that they represented, did not always have the exact same agenda that they were bringing to the table, although women's oppression was always underlining whatever their issues were, but racial justice, workplace justice, all of these issues too were there. But the key component, the key element that they all shared in 1919 was that they wanted their ideas to play a part in the conversation. They wanted to be able to help shape international policy. A new world government was being born for the first time in 1919, the League of Nations, which was the predecessor to today's United Nations. And in order to be able to help shape international policy and national policy moving forward, they needed to be recognized as legitimate political actors. And that's what they were asking for first and foremost.
Because some of the women, or a number of the women representing the American interest in this, were white and were well off, sometimes the early women's rights movement is carved into a certain stereotype. Because of the broadness of it, and your book makes so many storylines and pictures so vivid, is it time to rethink what the beginnings of this movement were, at least for the United States?
Absolutely. This book of mine is not a book of American history per se, but there are many American women featured in it. And actually, relatively few of them are white or wealthy. I discuss Mary Church Turrell and Ida Gibbs Hunt, both African-American civil rights activists who came to Paris in 1919 in order to stress a dual racial justice and gender equality agenda. They include women like Rose Schneiderman, who was a union organizer from New York's Lower East Side, lived in abject poverty as an immigrant sweatshop worker in New York, but who had risen up through the union ranks and who was able to come to Paris and meet directly with President Wilson and speak before the Labor Commission. So I'm hoping, particularly here in America, that the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage is an opportunity for us to expand the conversation and recognize the rich diversity of the participants in the women's rights movements nationally and internationally 100 years now, and also the wealth of issues that they brought to the table.
I want to go now to a couple sentences in your epilogue. You write, "Women's demands in 1919 were not a sideshow. They spoke to the issues at the heart of the negotiations, peace, stability, and democracy. Although they did not all speak in the same voice, female activists of 1919 variously rejected the Versailles settlement as a treaty of retribution. They demanded an end to imperialism and racial inequality. They insisted on economic justice for all workers, irrespective of sex, and reclaimed the right of all people to elect their representatives." Those battles sometimes don't sound so far from where we are in 2020.
Many of those battles continue really unabated today. And, you know, I do hope that readers that come to my book find some inspiration in the tenacity of these pioneering women who I discuss and whose actions I talk about, but also really recognize the importance of the issues that they were bringing forward, that the idea of gender equality is not a special interest agenda that only affects half the population. And that's already a big only. Mm. But the very security and peace that was so elusive in 1919 and that we continue to strive for today depends on empowering women across civil, social, economic, political, society. And that's the agenda that we're still fighting, as you alluded to earlier, in the women's marches, in the Me Too movement, in Black Lives Matter. They're all still there with us today.
We should follow this conversation with another one later in the year, closer to that August anniversary of the 19th Amendment, because it's important to talk about the legacies of the activism back then and the impact in not being listened to at that point in time and the way it's carved history since then. But I will remind everybody that you do have a book signing Friday, January 24th at 7:30 at the Avid Reader Davis. Thank you so much. This has been a very tiny conversation compared to all that's in your really beautiful book, and I appreciate you bringing it to us. Let's continue the conversation in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you, Beth.
That is Dr. Mona Siegel, and you're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. Stay with Cap Radio for NPR's gavel-to-gavel coverage of the Senate impeachment trial. You can continue to find new content from Insight online and by podcast at capradio.org/insight.